You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret White,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Mando Lucas Correa.
Thanks for tuning into Author Stories today. We've got a fantastic show coming up for you. As always, go to HankGarner.com where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere that you like to get your author interviews, you can find us there. I'd like to thank Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White today for sponsoring this episode with their book, The Fire Thief. She fights to survive, but only white-hot rage will reveal her true power. Remembering the hope of the past helps Stasha endure her bleak present. Blaming herself for her best friend's injury, she brawls and steals to provide in a world run by Faye. But with an arranged marriage approaching, Stasha swipes two silvers in hope of their escape and erupts into a fiery burst of magic. Surprised and confused by power she can't possibly control, Stasha barely has time to register that her friend has been sent off to die. With time running out and no options left, she must put her faith in powerful strangers as they dive into a Fae skirmish for supremacy. Surrounded by dubious allies, her only hope to redeem her past is to mount an attack on an inescapable death camp. As Stasha fights to free her friend, the battle she's faced her whole life is about to become a war. The Fire Thief is the first book in an exhilarating high fantasy series. If you like gutsy heroines, elemental magic, and epic sword and sorcery action, then you'll love New York Times bestselling authors Aaron St. Pierre and Gwen White's Roller Coaster Tale. Buy The Fire Thief to unlock an ancient fae destiny today. Also thanks to Patrice Fitzgerald and the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. There are 5 volumes out, and a 6th one comes out this summer in the Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series. Each release includes between 10 and 15 short stories, followed by a Q&A with the author. Some of the writers are New York Times and USA Today bestsellers. Some readers are saying, "It's a blisteringly good collection. These stories are full of great complex characters, not all of them human. Twists and turns and fantastic world building. Epic space battles, exotic aliens, far-flung planets. 15 fabulous tales that will thrill and surprise you, some chosen from previous Beyond the Stars volumes and some brand new, are in the Best Of collection. Come along as these award-winning authors sweep you along on adventures as broad as the universe and as deep as their imagination. The Beyond the Stars Space Opera Anthology series, pick it up today. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am really excited to have Armando Lucas Correa back on the show with me. Armando was on the show about a year and a half or 2 years ago when his first book, The German Girl, came out. And after we recorded, the book went on to have massive success and was really well received. And Armando has followed that book up with a new one called The Daughter's Tale. And when you're hearing this, it's out available everywhere. I've had the book for, I don't know, a little over a month or so, and it is absolutely amazing. Everything that was great about The German Girl, this book does twice as well. Welcome back to the show, Armando.
Thank you, Hank. I think it was almost 2 years ago.
I think it was.
Before the book, it was like, you know, a bestseller here in Canada and Colombia. I think it was one of the first interview that I did with you.
That's amazing. You've been on quite a journey since then. As you are no newcomer to the world of publishing, because as we talked about last time, and I'll put a link to the last show in the show notes so people can go catch up if they missed it.
Mm-hmm.
But you work in publishing in the magazine mm-hmm. business. How has your life changed, and how has your ideas about storytelling changed since having this novel come out that was so well received and so well respected? And how is it different from the daily work that you do?
It's completely different. But at the end, you know, working in People in Español is a magazine here in Meredith in New York, and we're a storyteller. We're all the time trying to tell a story to our audience, even if it's online, or in videos, or in print. And at the same time, I think the people who follow me as a editor of People in Español, they started knowing me as an author too. And it's interesting. Every time that I present the book, people ask me about celebrity. And it's an interesting relationship that I created 2 years ago with the audience. Yeah.
The book, The German Girl, a couple of years ago that released, mm-hmm. we'll just recap really quickly, was based on true-to-life events that had been mostly forgotten by mm-hmm. most people. But this was a story that you were very passionate about because it had some personal ties to
exactly,
you.
Yeah.
If you would just briefly kind of remind people about where that story came from and how you got involved with this historical
event. The first book, The German Girl, is about the tragedy of the MSS St. Louis. This is an ocean liner who left Germany in 1939, Nazi Germany, with over 900 Jewish refugees. All of them, they have permit of disembark in Cuba. And when they arrived in May 27, I think, 1939, they were rejected by the Cuban government. They requested another $500 per passenger. That's a fortune at that moment. And June 2nd, they left Havana, and they tried to find refugee in United States, and Roosevelt denied entrance, and Mackenzie in Canada, too. They ended in Europe, in France, Belgium, Holland, and Great Britain, and the only who survived, you know, the tragedy of the war, it was the one in Great Britain. Most of them, they ended in Auschwitz. And I grew up with a story. I am Cuban, and I remember when I was a child, around 10 years old, my grandmother from my mother's side, she's a daughter of the Spanish refugees that they arrived at the beginning of the 20th century to Cuba. And she was telling all the time, talking to my grandfather, that Cuba is going to pay very dearly because what they did to the Jewish refugees. When I was a teenager, I realized that my grandmother was pregnant with my mom when the boat arrived in Havana. Then I tried, when I went to college, I tried to find more about the St. Louis, and nothing. Nobody knew about this story. I'm trying to go to the library, and then when I was preparing my thesis for college, and I went to the National Archive, and I talked to this old lady in front of the office, and she said that they used to have like a three big boxes dedicated to the St. Louis, and all of them disappeared during the 70s. And then when I arrived in United States in 1991, I started, you know, collecting everything related to the St. Louis articles, book, paraphernalia, you know, everything, mugs, plates. I have like a huge collection of the St. Louis. And I was obsessed with this story at the beginning because I am a journalist. I want to try to do like a nonfiction book, but I want to be out of my comfort zone. And I think at the end, when you create like emotional connection with the audience, the story is going to be big and more influential at the end. Because there is a lot of book about the St. Louis, but nobody talk about it. I don't know. I remember when I presented the idea like 5 years ago to Simon & Schuster, to the editors, it was the first time that they heard about the St. Louis. And then finishing the book, when I sent the book to my editor, and I have a lot of story on the table, and I want to write a second book and a third book and create this kind of trilogy about a story that people tend to forget or tend to avoid. And I think because it's easy to say Hitler killed 6 million Jewish, but when you said that United States, Canada, or France, or Cuba was part of the tragedy, you know, there is a shame behind that. And you're trying to forget when something is shameful. I think so. Yeah,
I think you're absolutely right. And the German Girl was my first introduction to this story. I had never heard of this story, and it's so easy to. And I think this is why historical fiction is so important. And we talk about it a lot on the show. Is that the farther away from an historical event we get, the more that thing is reduced down to just a set of bullet points, and we lose all of the nuance, and we lose all of the personal stories of what happened. And I think that's why historical fiction is so important. It allows us to go deeply into the story of these people, and that's what we really care about, is the story of these people and what role we might have played in it. It's so easy to look at Hitler or Mussolini or Stalin as these great bad guys that we can pin all of the bad of the world on, and the truth is that we have a role to play in that a lot of times, and we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear
that last year. I am proud of that, because Prime Minister in Canada, they organized like a kind of apology in the center of the government, and I helped them to invite all the St. Louis survivors, and they were the children of the St. Louis, and it was very emotional to see all these old people, crying and listening to the Prime Minister, Trudeau, talking about the shame that they have to, carry on until today, that they denied the entrance of all these refugees. And one of the survivors is living in Canada, and right now is a Canadian citizen.
Wow. So you tell the story of these people and what happened. What were some of the responses that you got from readers who were not familiar with the story, but the story became alive to them through your words?
Yeah, the book has been translated to over, I think, 15 languages now, and it's in more than 25 countries. And in every place it's different. I remember talking to people in Colombia, in Latin America, and they feel like we never learn from history, no? And it's always like that kind of response, that they feel that the book is current for everything that is happening. In United States, when you go to different part of the country, not New York and LA, I'm talking about the middle of the country, they try to tend to read the book in a different way, I think. And it's not general. When you talk to some of these readers, they avoid sometimes some of the reader about the responsibility that we have, I think. Some of them know, but, most of the audience, they are not Jewish, and they feel like they follow the plot more than the historical responsibility. This is one of the reactions that sometimes shocked me. But everybody has an emotional connection with the story. For me, read is very important. It's part of it's like eating. No, read. Read is part of my day. And we don't have time. And I always think that reading has to be entertaining. That's important too. But you have to learn something. Even if you're watching a Marvel movie or whatever, you need to learn something, because the time that you have is minimum. And then when you are reading, I always like that my readers learn something from the book. In this case, you're learning something that happened many years ago, and there is some kind of responsibility.
Well, the one thing about that, Armando, is that even if someone says that the plot and the action and the intrigue and all of that is what resonates with them, and not necessarily the personal responsibility aspect, no matter whether it strikes them now or later, you have planted that story, and it can no longer be avoided.
True.
They have the story now. They own it. And and I think just as the writer, as the storyteller, you have to trust that that you've done your job, and when it needs to come to surface, it will.
No, that's true. Yeah.
So the new book, The Daughter's Tale, where did this story come from, and is this another part of this personal connection story that you have?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I decided to write the trilogy, the three books, the first one is The German Girl, the second one is The Daughter's Tale, and the last one is going to be The Night Traveler. I'm trying to write about this part of the history that nobody talk about it. The first one, it was the St. Louis. The second one, it was Oradour-sur-Glane. This is a small village in the south of France that someday in June, in middle of the summer, in 1942, I think exactly, the Nazis arrive and they decide to move, all the women and children inside the church. And they burned down life, all these people, and destroyed the whole village. And what is the reason? I went to Limoges, part of my research. I went to see the Oradour-sur-Glane. When you see the postcard, they look like it's a couple of street blocks, and a church and a square in the middle of the beautiful countryside French town. But when you go there, it's massive, it's a big town. It's like you think that you are destroying in New York, the whole Upper West Side. And the dimension, it was really impacting me when I saw the real, destruction. Right now, it's a memorial. After the war, Charles de Gaulle decided to rebuild the town on the site and keep the ruins like a memorial. But if you go to France today, nobody knows about this story. And the people don't talk about this story. And you know why? Because it was the Nazi who decided to do, all this crime. But part of the group who participated, it was a French soldier. And there was a law after the war that they cannot prosecute this French soldier because they were, receiving order from the Nazis. Most of them, they were from this part of Alsacia, the border with German, and they speak German, but they were French soldiers. And right now, I think there is one of the soldiers, and they want to put her on trial. He was like 18 years old, I think. And this story resonates with me when I remember I have a couple of postcards. I don't know why I'm upset with this kind of thing. And then the third one, The Night Traveler, is going to be about a little girl, living in Berlin with her mother, and she has to leave at night and run in the park at night. And she learned that the mother has to save her, but she doesn't understand why. And the problem, the girl is Micheline. Micheline, it was a term that the Nazi use when you have a mixed race. And this is the case of a mother, she's white, Aryan, perfect, blonde and blue eyes. And she has a daughter with a guy from the colonies, from a black guy. And she's a Micheline. And there was a law that Hitler created that if you are a 7 years old girl, and you want to survive, not to go to a concentration camp, you have to sterilize, or it's Micheline, a mixed race. And this is a mother trying to find a boat with a family to take the daughters out of Germany. And the only boat and the people who were living at that moment was Jewish people. And she find a family, and then I'm in this book, I'm going back to Cuba with this family, and she grow up in Cuba as a Jewish girl. Then she grew up, she get married, and after the revolution in 1959, it was terrible for most of the family trying to send the kids back, outside the Cuba, and they create an operation called Peter Pan that they took without their parents, they sent children, over 20,000 children to United States with the help of the Catholic Church. And most of the children, you know, they grew up in the United States without family, with the new languages, and they never met the parents again, half of them. And this girl, you know, grew up in the United States, and she go back to Berlin to trying to find the books. The mother was a poet, the grandmother was a poet, and trying to find the apartment and what happened at the end with her grandmother. This is the third book. But, you know, this is another part of the story that nobody talk about, because the, how do you pronounce that? Is when they, eugenic, no? You know what is eugenic? When they decide what is the best race?
Eugenics.
Eugenic, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And they, Hitler and his team, they study and they decide and how to proceed with eugenic, with some of the studies that an American guy created in Pasadena, California. It was it was the inspiration to create the law with the study, you know, created. And I have one of these books that it cost me a fortune, the original one from the 1920s in Pasadena, California. And then, you know, I trying to revisit all this part of the history that we're trying to forget, I think.
I think that's so important, Armando. Mm-hmm. It's that we don't forget, you know, where we came from, the mistakes that we made. Mm-hmm. Celebrate the victories, of course. We should always do that, but we should mm-hmm. also approach history with a little humility. I think that's always mm-hmm. a strong thing to do. To know that we can learn, and maybe we could do better in this generation than some of the things we did in the past. One thing that I love about your books is that you take these complicated pieces of history and these really dark things that happened, but you put an absolute human face on them. You make characters that I immediately care about. And characters that I want to see succeed, and I want to share in their pain and in their struggle, and then, you know, ultimately in their redemption and victory. How do you start seeing characters come out of these situations when you collect all this memorabilia, or you do research and you start seeing kind of the big overall story? How do you bring that down to a personal level to make a character that me, a man in 2019, can open up the book and immediately feel a connection to?
I think this is something that all the writers do. You know, we always trying to start writing about our own experience. You know what I mean? Even if you are writing about historical fiction, and you know, I am not Jewish, but I am a father and I have a family. At the end, I'm a Cuban refugee. You know, I left my country and I tried to reinvent myself here and learn a new language and create my family. And I remember when I was writing The German Girl, I always thinking about my daughter, and the first sentence of the book, if I trying to reproduce right now, is like, I'm gonna be 12 years old and I decided to kill my parents. And I remember when I started writing, I gonna be 9 years old, because my daughter Emma was growing up at the same time like the character, you know? And then it was 12 years old because it was the age of Emma, and it was better to have an older age on the book. And I was all the time thinking like my daughter and me as a father, and that kind of relationship with the parent, that you need to do whatever you have to do to save your children. And that happened with the daughter still. And, you know, I always surrounded about books. I decided that the mother is going to be a bookstore owner, and if you have to save something, what is the book? You know, if you have to burn, they're gonna burn all your books. What is the book that you're gonna save? What is the most important one for you? That kind of decision is always thinking, and I use it, you know, like me as a writer. And at the same time, you have two daughters. You have to make a terrible decision, but you have to save them, and you have to do whatever you have to do to save them. But telling the truth, I don't think I can do something like that. I cannot survive without my children. And living in the middle of the world, I know you have another strength when you have that kind of situation. And for you, it's more important that your children are alive than to be separated from them. But I cannot take that kind of decision. It's for me, that's impossible. Even when you take a plane, I travel a lot. I never think about that accident or something. let me talk the table, because tomorrow I'm going to take a plane. And I never think about it. But my partner is all the time freaking out when he's going to take a plane. But you know, when the day I was freaking out, when I was invited to present the German Girl in the Apple, you know, the big company in Cupertino. And my partner wanted to see the big building and meet the Tim Cook is gonna receive us, and they gonna give us a tour, and he wants to go. When we take the plane together, and we left the children with the babysitter in New York, you know, I was in panic all the time. I feel pain in my body, because. And then if I travel, you know, my children, they are with him. Or if he's traveling, I am with them. But living together, and that kind of situation is all the time when I'm writing about family. I am obsessed with family and children and the war. And I grew up with women, strong women, my grandmother, my daughter, my mother, my sister, my aunt, and I think everything is in my book, even if not part of the story. I never lived in France or in Germany or something like that. But you write about your experience.
Right.
Even you're talking about something from 3,000 years ago.
Right. Well, it's finding that thing that connects you to the type of fear and pain helps to channel that into the story, that, you know, you're scared for your children when you and your partner are away. And I think kind of tapping into that emotion helps to bring us back to that time with the other character. It's all finding that emotion that's going to resonate with people.
Yeah.
One thing I love about your books, and especially the new one, is you've got the dual timelines. You've got two different stories going on. You've got New York in 2015 mm-hmm. and Berlin in 1939, where we're seeing what happened then and sort of the fallout now of, or, mm-hmm. you know, close to present day, and how those decisions that happened then, how those world events and how those personal events have an impact through time on people that we now interact with, and maybe the people that we are, nothing happens in the past that isn't felt in the future. And when you start writing this book and you've got the two timelines, how do you come up with the story that's going to tell the other story, so to speak?
I always think when you are in the middle of the war on something that will happen, or you are a refugee and you have to, in my case, I always try to forget the bad things or the sad thing or the tragedies. I try to reinvent myself. When you left your country, you have to abandon your family and create a new thing. No? And in another scale, because I'm not comparing, you know, my situation in Cuba with the Holocaust, you and you are a child, you try to create a new life and block all the tragedy from the past. And I met a lot of survivors, I most of them, you know, from the St. Louis, that they create a new family in Mexico, for example, in this case, and they don't want to talk about the Holocaust, and they want to create a new life, a new identity. And then now is they are trying to get these old memories. And this is a situation that I want to be reflected in the book. When I met Judy Steele, she was one of the survivors from the St. Louis, and I talked to the survivor after I finished the book because I wanted to sound the German girl. I wanted to sound like a fairy tale, you know. It was my kind of the story or my vision of the story that my grandmother passed to me. Even I did a lot of research, but I didn't want to talk to the survivor until I finished the book. Because when I talked to Judith in this case, my mind started writing a new book. And even the daughter Estelle, I have I knew it's going to be based on the Orador Sur Glane and this old lady with a different identity, and she with a letter she's going to find who really she was or she is. And Judith gave me the climax of the book. When I talked to Judith, she explained to me that, you know, they were sent back to France with her grandfather, mother, and father, and they have a happy life for a couple of months until the Nazi arrived. When the Nazi arrived, they were sent to a temporary camp controlled by the French police. And she was happy there too because, you know, she was a child and she was like 5 years old or 4 years old and playing freely with all the children in the camp. But one night she was taken to the middle of the forest with her father in this case. And the father said, look at the top of the tree. And at that moment, the father ran away and she was with a French family. And she grew up with a French family. She never saw her parents again because that night they were sent to Auschwitz. And he exchanged her with jewelry to this family and saved her at the end. And for me, it was like I was talking before, you know, this father abandoned a daughter to save her. And I said, I have to use that situation with the mother and the child in the middle of the forest. And, you know, she's going to be with me in one of the presentations that I'm going to do in New York. And right now she's like 82 years old. And she went to India. She traveled a lot now. But she's a beautiful old lady with all these memories. And you know, and she loved my book, and I'm proud of that. Yeah.
You should be. As a father yourself, and such a passionate father that you are, you talk about your relationship with your daughter, and how much that means to you when you're writing scenes like that. That is so powerful from a parent's perspective. Do you ever find yourself just overwhelmed and like I can't write this right now? I've got to give myself, I've got to let myself get okay with this. Because I do that sometimes, or it's just too much. I just can't do that right now. I've got to get to a place where I'm able to do that.
It's happened all the time, and I always very involved. You know, I love to play with word sentences and my paragraph. I want it to be perfect. But at the same time, I have, and you see in my book, I always have this emotional connection with the story and the details and the characters. And I remember when I was writing The German Girl, one of my favorite part is in the when Hannah in Cuba, she almost create a fantasy like Leo, you know. Her best friend died in the middle of the boat, you know? And when I was writing about this father trying to make a terrible decision because they don't want to go back to Germany, I was crying, and at that moment I think my son has like like 4 years old or 3 years old, and he was in the bathroom, and he called me, "Dad, Dad, I finished game, please." And and then I run to the bathroom. He said, "What happened? Why you're crying?" You know, I never forgot that story. And then I said, "I need to stop right now, and you know, and go to the pool with my son." It was in Miami, middle of the summer, and because I really very involved emotionally with my books. That's the reason, and this is, I don't know, okay, I'm going to tell you. Every time that I finish, when I finish The German Girl, I start to write about something completely different. And when I finished The Daughter's Tale, I did the same. But my editor at that moment in Simon & Schuster, Johanna Castillo, said, "No, you have to," because I was writing a completely different book. Because it was like my cleaning myself from this emotional thing, no? And then my editor said, "No, you have to concentrate the trilogy. You have a lot of work to do for the next years." And she left Simon & Schuster. Right now she's an agent. Not my agent. It was too late. And I said, "Okay, now I'm going to finish the book." And I finished. I finished like a couple of weeks ago. And right now I'm going to start working on the translation. And the edition is called The Silence in Her Eyes. And it's a kind of psychological thriller. And it's always about mother and daughters. And but it's a completely different story because I have to clean myself and separate myself from the story. I think at the same time, between The Daughter's Tale and The Night Traveler, I think my readers need something different in between. I think so.
I think so too. I think so too. I think it's good to have a palate cleanser of sorts, because then when you come back,
fresh.
Yes. And you've sorted some things out in your mind by doing something else. I know you've said before that, when you're stuck, on a book and not sure where to go, it usually comes to you when you're going to sleep and kind of when you're sorting out that. So I think the same thing happens when we go to work on something else, the things that were, you know, maybe have questions about, sort themselves out too.
Yeah.
You work at, as you mentioned, at People Español, and you write a Spanish magazine for English speaking people, or for people that live in English speaking countries. When you write your novels, are you writing in English or Spanish first?
Well, I write in Spanish, but all the time I'm thinking how it's going to sound in English. For example, the first paragraph, I always change it because I want to sound the same in English and in Spanish. I work really close with Nate Kaiser. He's one of the best, you know, English translator from Spanish. He lives in London, and I am proud that he chose me to work with all my book because he's a kind of or diva, no? He works with all these big names, Isabel Allende, Pérez Reverte, you know, from the Hispanic world. And I remember when my editor started talking, who's going to be the translator for The German Girl, he sent me three tests that she asked for different translator and without a name. And then when I read it, I said, "Johanna, this is the only one who can translate my book." I said, "Armando, he's the most expensive one, first of all, and he needs to read the whole book, and he decides he's going to work with you or not." And thank God, he decided he's going to work with all my books, and even he's going to translate The Silence in Your Eyes, too. But I work really close with him, and sometimes I am like his nightmare because he said, "Marlo, that's impossible. You know, he lives in London, lives in New York with different hours. We're talking in the middle of the midnight." And in The German Girl, it was more difficult because some of the part of the story is in Cuba, and Cuba is a little complicated. I use some title of songs, boleros, that they are very dramatic and they're kind of a fantasy. And they said that that don't sound well in English. Well, this is the name of the sun, you know. And I remember it was like the earrings that the moon is wearing. Something like that. It sounds cheesy, but they said, we need to find another title. I explained, Nick, we can't change the title of a bolero.
Like, it is what it is.
And he's like an editor too. And he talked to me, we need to find another way to say it because I want to have your voice in English. And then sometimes I rewrite in Spanish because, you know, it's another process that I enjoy really well. Most of the author, you know, like Isabel or Arturo Perez Rivera, they don't care about the translation in English. Or they care, but they trust the translator, and that's it. No, I worked really close with my translator, and even I read the translation before the editor, and I try to do some change, and I talk to Nick if we want to change or cut, because, you know, in Spanish we talk a lot and our sentences, they are longer than in English. You know, in English everything is fast and short.
Right. Well, I think that's super important. And I don't know that authors always get the chance to have that much input into translations but I think you have the benefit of writing and reading and editing in both languages, so that helps. And because this book, we're dealing with multiple continents, multiple people groups, in that, you know, we've got the story taking place in New York and in Berlin, in the German girl in Cuba, also. So it's extra important to get all of the flavor and nuance right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And even I'm trying to, in this case, the title, we change the title in English. Because in The German Girl, we keep La Niña Alemana, The German Girl. In The Daughter's Tale, the title in Spanish is La Hija Olvidada, that in Spanish sounds beautiful, but in English is little, you know, is in English it could be the Forgotten Daughter. And forgotten is, it's a strong word. It doesn't sound like olvido. To have an idea, nobody's name, you never name a person forgot or forgotten. In Spanish, that's a name for a woman.
Uh-huh.
And then that's the reason that the Forgotten Daughter, La Hija Olvidada, olvido is a name. And then in Spanish, it's beautiful. Sometimes in right now, the daughter said it's sold to Germany, Holland, Sweden, Brazil, Portugal, and Hungary too. And we are offering what is going to sound better, if the daughter sell or La Hija Olvidada, when you are going to do the translation.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, in different languages, for example, The German Girl, right now I just came from Paris because The German Girl is going to be published in French in September, and they decide to change the title. And I agree because, you know, they know the market more than me, because The German Girl, for them, they said they sound weird in French, and they decide that they, I think because they hate German. No, I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. But they don't want to put the. Let me see what is. I don't know if I have the name. No. And they decide to put the passenger of the San Luis. It's going to be the title, La Passagère de San Luis. It's going to be in French.
Which is what it is.
Exactly. No, I like it.
I like that too. That's everybody has a different take on what the story means to them, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But in all the translation for The German Girl, they keep the same title. The only place they changed it was in Germany, because the real title of the magazine, The German Girl, is like German is like they need like a three word for one word.
Right.
And there was too much information in the real title of the magazine. And they decide to put the heritage of the Rosenthals, that I really don't like it. Even, you know, the book was a bestseller there because it sounds like, I don't know, it sounds I prefer The Passing of St. Louis, for example, in the title. And the other country, it was a trip to Havana. It was Norway. They changed the title. But the, all of them, the, you know, even Taiwan, they keep The German Girl.
Huh. How about that? Well, what does it feel like to have your books enjoyed worldwide? You know, this is more than just, because you know, we talked about earlier that this is really a story about all of our responsibility in these things that we like to blame on other people, so to speak. But this is really a worldwide phenomenon, and is it because people can see themselves in a story like this no matter where they're from?
I think so. And, you know, many in Europe, that is part of their story. I know there is a lot of book, but in this case, the responsibility of, you know, countries like United States, Cuba, and Canada, I think they resonate in a bigger way. I think this is one of the reasons. And one of the countries that they published the book, and it was interesting because it was in the middle of the big political crisis, it was Poland. And they call Niemka, is the German, like, the little German girl is the name that they put in Niemka. But the, I don't know if you remember, they create a law that you cannot blame Polish people for the what happened during the Holocaust. No, because, you know, they have Auschwitz in the backyard. And they don't want to blame the, and a lot of, you know, Polish people, you know, was part of the crime. And then my book, it was out at that moment, and the editor was worried because they can be prosecuted if you tell something that you blame another people more than the German. But thank God we never talk about Poland specifically. I mentioned Auschwitz, but it was like a reference, and the book did well. I don't know if they're going to buy the daughter's cell now. Because this is, you know, I went to Auschwitz and I went to Krakow, and they are very, very sensitive with the Holocaust.
I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
Well, Armando, the book, The Daughter's Tale, is out everywhere now. It's been out for a couple of days when people are hearing this. Available in hardcover, audiobook, and ebook from wherever you get your books. You can read The Daughter's Tale. Armando, it's been so much fun catching up again. If people are just getting familiar with you and your work, where can they find you online to follow all along and to watch the news about the rest of your work?
I have my website, armandolucascorrea.com, but you can go through thegermangirl.com, thedaughterscell.com. But you put my name and you're going to find I'm trying to update the book tour, because for The Daughter's Tale, I never thought it was going to be that kind of big. You know, I'm going to go to Australia, to Colombia, to Sweden, to Canada, and I'm going to be very busy for the whole summer, and fall and winter too. Yeah, but I am very happy. I'm very happy that their reception, because, you know, I heard from my editor that in United States, they you know, here they don't read a lot of translation, and I think it's like a 1% of the book that. And most of the publishing houses sell. They are the only translation is 1%, and I feel like lucky that my book is resonating, you know, in the whole country.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to send everybody to see you and to pick up their copy of The Daughter's Tale. There's links to it in the show notes, and to The German Girl, which we highly recommend everyone start with that book. Can't wait to see how the trilogy is going to end. Armando, and to see how the thriller is going to come out. But thank you so much for taking time to come back on the show.
Maybe I'm going to talk to you in a couple of years too, or maybe before.
let's plan on it.
Okay, thank you, Han.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
Hello, young one. What ghoulish tale of horror shall we explore tonight? Shall we watch The Creep Show? The Nightmare on Elm Street? Child of the Night, give me your answer.
Which one would Mom kill us for watching? Said Buddy. Dad grinned and his eyes grew wide.
Which do you think, Child of the Jackal?
The Omen!
And we might have time for Omen too, if we hurry. She'll be home by 11.
I'll be back. Buddy ran to his room. He stripped down to his Yoda underwear and fished in the closet. 2 minutes later, he snuck back into the living room wearing his skeleton costume from last Halloween. He crept up behind his dad, who was cueing the movie. But David Rittermeier was too clever for that. He spun around at the last moment and bared fang teeth torn from paper plates, drawing a yip of surprise and a cry of, "No fair!" Daddy kicked off his Reeboks, plopped his smelly gym socks on the coffee table, another thing that Mom would hate, and killed the lights. The scary intro music began. The screen showed the silhouette of a boy, about Buddy's age. His shadow was a long, creepy cross. The Antichrist, the son of the devil. Born of a jackal on a night of astrological portent, destined to bring about the end times and the final battle of good versus evil. Buddy sipped Sunkist and scooted up next to his dad. As the movie got scarier, he slipped an arm through his father's and cupped his big bicep. Buddy could feel his father's pulse. Dads get scared, too. They flinched together, shouted together, pointed at the screen and covered their faces together. Buddy pressed his eyes to Daddy's shoulder just before the on-screen maid shouted, "It's all for you, Damien!" and dove from the roof, hanging herself. Buddy knew which parts he was old enough to watch and which parts he wasn't. He trusted his dad to let him know when to look again. Occasionally, his dad tricked him into peeking too soon, but that was part of the fun. They kicked their feet at the screen and shouted, "Look up! Look up! Oh, idiot! Don't get yourself killed!" At the climax, the hero of the movie, Mr. Thorne, discovered a birthmark of 3 sixes on his son's head and dragged the little Antichrist to the altar of the church, determined to spear his son with holy daggers and end evil forever. After it was over, the Rittermeier men sat silently through the credits. David put an arm around his son and ran his fingers through Buddy's hair. He wasn't searching for devil marks. He knew there weren't any. And Buddy was certain there were no daggers in his father's hand, either. Those things were just make-believe. Real fathers and sons don't do bad things to each other. They were queuing up Omen 2 when the power went out.
"No,"
Buddy whined.
"Not on movie night."
Daddy went to the window. "It's the whole block. Sorry, Damien. How about, scary blackout? Go get the Ouija board out of the guest room closet.
Cool.
And candles." Buddy found the Ouija board, hidden under old clothes. When he shut the sliding door again, the sight of a monster startled him, and he let out an involuntary, "Huh!" sound. It was his own skeleton-bodied reflection in the mirrored closet door. He stared at it. He liked the effect of moonlight on his cheeks. Spectral, haunted, his eyes big and white. He clacked his teeth at himself, picturing his own grinning skull under his child's flesh, and gave an evil laugh. He was answered by a scream. A woman's scream. High-pitched and far away. One of the neighbors? Buddy dropped the Ouija board into a patch of moonlight and sat with it.
"What's going on?"
he whispered, his fingers on the heart-shaped wood planchette.